Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 563. My name is Camden Busey. I'm pastor of Hope OPC up in Grays Lake, Illinois. And I'm delighted to be back today. We've got a really fun episode and a new guest, but let me introduce to you first. We have Jim Cassidy, our good friend, who is the pastor of South Austin OPC in South Austin, Texas. Welcome back, Jim. It's great to speak with you.
It's good to be here with you, Camden, as always.
Yeah, last episode I accidentally said Glenn is pastor at South Austin, so I don't know if I had some weird special revelation anticipation or some merging going on, but anyway, I got his name right. You know, that's the most important thing.
You were just trying to insult him, that's all.
Yeah, that's right. Well, for those of you watching the video, you'll see we have a very special guest. We're very pleased today to welcome to the program for the first time Dr. Whitney Gamble. She's Associate Professor of Biblical and Theological Studies at Providence Christian College. Welcome, Whitney. It's great to speak with you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah. Well, today we're going to be speaking about a new book. We're really excited to speak about this series that we've talked about before, Studies on the Westminster Assembly, which is published by Reformation Heritage Books. But Whitney's written the volume Christ and the Law, Antinomianism at the Westminster Assembly. And we're very thankful for RHB sending us a copy so that we can work through this book. And as I said before we started recording, I've read every word and very much enjoyed it. We're going to dive down into this history and get even more information and perspective on the Westminster Assembly. We know that's so near and dear to the hearts of many of our viewers and listeners as brothers and sisters and people who follow after and subscribe to the Westminster Standards. But helping us to understand the theological context and more than that, the historical context is Dr. Gamble today. So a couple things to mention before we get into our episode specifics. We do want to point people to the website. We're recording this before our fall conference. However, given the schedule, this should come out roughly a week later. And so if you go to reformedforum.org, you should be able to find all of our recorded lectures and things from the conference here at Hope OPC, October 5th through 7th. And there should be plenty of video and audio that you can download and watch and follow along. We were planning to live stream the event, and hopefully many of you were able to watch it if you weren't able to be here. But if not, it should be all available online, and we'd still love your interaction. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the subject matter and continue the conversation. So that's all at reformedforum.org. But while you're there, we encourage you to check out the other events. We have a really wonderful event coming up in April 2019 down in Wimberley, Texas, which isn't too far away from where Jim Cassidy and Glenn Clary serve as pastors at different churches, although they're close by. We're going to have a very unusual but a special event at a place called the Old Glory Ranch, and then we also have some special lodging opportunities. So if you'd like to come down and hang out, Lane Tipton will be teaching a 12-lecture series over the course of 3 days on kind of the foundations of covenant theology. He's going to do a deep dive into Genesis 1 through 3, but it's at an adult Sunday school level. It's going to be meaty and rich, but it's not inaccessible if you're not theologically trained or a scholar or anything. Don't worry about it. But also, if you'd like to stay at the location where we're hanging out and would like to continue the theological conversation throughout the evenings and well into the night, you know, Jim will be happy to answer all of your theological questions, you know, well into the early hours of the morning, I'm sure. So all of that's online. You can find out information about that at reformedforum.org. You can register. Registration is open as we speak, and we look forward to meeting you and seeing you and talking to you in April in Texas. Well, let's turn to the book here. I'm so glad to get this book. I mean, there's several books in the series now, and we've spoken to some of the authors before, and you can find try to put links to those in the episode description for this podcast if you'd like to follow along. But today we're speaking about an important subject. Not that anything relative to the Westminster Assembly is unimportant. I'm sure there's more minutiae in some studies than others. But today we're getting to the heart of the gospel as we're speaking about Christ and the law and about antinomianism at the Westminster Assembly. It's a really contentious subject. trying to understand, you know, the dynamics of the different people, the divines at the assembly and their different views. And also something that is definitely applicable to contemporary Reformed theology and evangelicalism. We were talking beforehand of just how much of this has been brought up and discussed in recent years. And I know brothers at my church have been studying Ferguson's The Whole Christ. We went through a Ligonier series, a Sunday school series on that, talking a lot about antinomianism there. And it's utterly important that we get these questions right. And it's also important that we understand the history and where all of these, the context in which many of these theological statements were forged. So Whitney, with all that being said, I'd just like to ask you a bit about your studies. What led you to this point to do the research? Where did you do the research? And what gave rise ultimately to the book that we now have in our hands today?
Well, it was a process. I studied at the University of Edinburgh, and I began my studies there actually intending to study John Owen and Owen's debates on justification and sanctification and how the two went together. And he debated Richard Baxter on that. And Baxter calls Owen an antinomian. So part of my research was going to be, you know, uncovering that debate a little bit more, analyzing it, seeing if Baxter's allegations were true for Owen. So that's what I intended to do for my PhD. And in preparation for that, I started out by deciding to do a chapter on the Westminster Assembly, because the debates with Owen and Baxter were a little bit later in the 1650s, 1660s. But I thought, oh, I need to set the stage and see what was going on in the 40s, 1640s. Mm-hmm. And that was the Westminster Assembly. So I began doing just background research on the Westminster Assembly, diving into their minutes, which had recently kind of been uncovered with the work of Chadwin Dixhorn. And as I went into the minutes, analyzing them, reading through them, specifically the first volume of the minutes and an accompanying journal that one of the assembly members kept during the meetings, I realized that the Westminster Assembly had debates on these issues of the relationship between sanctification and justification, the work of Christ in our redemption, and pretty intricate debates, pretty, in my mind, exciting debates.
Oh, sure.
No one had really published on them, basically because they had been basically contained in minutes that were kind of lost until Chadwin mm-hmm. Dixon. So that's how it started.
Been such a tremendously exciting time as an historian to get into this study. These are the kinds of things historians really dream of, you know, being able to uncover things that have either been lost or never known. So, I mean, just jumping right in when Dr. Van Dixhorn is doing all this tremendous work, we've spoken with him several times in the past, but it must be, I mean, what more could you ask for?
It was pretty incredible. I look back and it was really God's hand of providence in leading me in that, because it made my studies very, I mean, not that they wouldn't have been fun anyway, but just an element of excitement that I think isn't maybe always there for a detailed.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. And you just almost have just a wide open field to get into these things and shed new light on some important discussions and important debates. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. Well, as we begin, you know, there's a lot of discussion about antinomianism, but maybe not always with the greatest precision. I mean, how do we even approach that word? And there's such a scale. You know, if Baxter called Owen an antinomian, Owen certainly could have called Baxter neonomian. and even today, there's such shifting views on these things, and kind of the neonomians of yesterday might be antinomians today or vice versa. It's just, how do we even get a handle on some of these things? How best should we understand antinomianism with regard to this particular historical context and to your particular study here?
Yeah, so that's a great point. And I make this point in the book that the antinomians that I'm dealing with in this study aren't historically, for instance, the antinomians that Luther or even Calvin were dealing with, you know, more than a century earlier in the 1500s. So they're very, the ones that I'm dealing with here are, it's a very fine distinction. So what exactly are the issues? What exactly is going on? And I make this point in the book that the antinomians really come from within the Reformed camp. So it is even in distinction with, well, some of the issues that are happening today. But in this case, they are part of what I would call Reformed Christians.
Sure.
Although the assembly will decide after their debates that antinomians technically don't follow Reformed Orthodoxy. So part of what I analyze is the assembly members wrestling through what exactly are the issues. Are these men heretics? They have a debate about that. What is heresy? At what point does something go from being misguided to being heretical? And some members of the assembly thought that these antinomians were heretical. Others said no. So it is a pretty complex issue that I think when we're doing historical theology, you have to be careful to stick within the bounds of what's going on historically at this time, which is different, you know, than even our current debates on antinomianism. It's a different field. There are different issues at play. So it does require a sensitivity to the context, definitely.
That's a tremendously interesting question to ask, you know, what was in the consciousness of many of the divines, and they were drawing a line of sorts, but the question is, what's the nature of that line? You know, and if you're outside of that line, what are you outside of? Either the Presbyterian tradition, the Reformed tradition? Are you not a Christian anymore? You know, but more than that, you also see the interplay between church and state, which is such a big feature of the assembly. And it's not only important to understand what the men at the assembly thought antinomianism was, but also why were they so concerned about it, and why did they feel the need to alert the state, the parliament at least, about its growth? Why was that important to them to tell, you know, civil magistrates about this supposed threat?
Yeah, that's a great question. And again, very different from our context. So the Westminster Assembly was a committee of parliament. It was a government committee, a political committee. And they were called by parliament. They were accountable to parliament. They were subservient to parliament. So that has to be, when we look at the issue, that has to be kept in mind. And their duty really was to alert parliament of any sort of theology that was aberrant, or any sort of theology that went against the 39 articles, which were the documents that the Church of England was governed by. So when the assembly meets, antinomianism is the first kind of theological system that they're alerted to, that people have heard reports that there are preachers going around preaching things that are contrary to the 39 articles. So the assembly begins by analyzing the 39 articles, analyzing these preachers, and comparing the two to see, okay, are they actually going against the 39 articles? If they are, Parliament needs to stop them. and the Westminster Assembly, it's their duty to alert Parliament that these men are going against the doctrine of the land, and they should be punished. There should be some sort of action taken against them. But the assembly realizes that they need to be very careful in making that determination. If they say these men are heretics, then that could bring some pretty severe civil punishment. So you see that in their debates, where they want to be careful, they want to protect these men. But at the same time, if there is a real theological danger, they do feel that they need to alert Parliament, and action needs to be taken.
That was helpful, very helpful context and backdrop. I hope my question is helpful for getting us into the substance of your book here. And as you're talking, I'm growing very curious as to now who are some of the names? What are some of the names of the people who are under suspicion? And more precisely, what is their what is the problem that they're, or what are the doctrines that they're teaching? What are they saying that has brought them under suspicion?
Yeah, so there's a little handful of guys. The main one, his name is John Eaton, E-A-T-O-N. Mm-hmm. And then there's another guy, John Simpson, and a few others. But John Eaton really becomes known as the quote unquote father of antinomianism. That can be debated too. Where did this actually begin? It's pretty scholars pretty much agree that he was kind of the first English antinomian in this strain. So his kind of main point was that once you're justified, God no longer sees your sin. And that was his kind of tagline. God no longer sees the sin of the justified, which sounds great. Our sins are covered by Christ. I like that. The Westminster Assembly like that. But what happened for Eaton was that it raised questions of, well, if God no longer sees your sin, what happens when you sin? Do you still sin? Do you get chastised? Does God chastise you for your sin? Does God punish you for your sin if you're a justified believer clothed in Christ's righteousness? And Eaton, and examples were brought to Eaton. For instance, classic example, David and Bathsheba, right? So what, David sins and he seems to be chastised by God, his son, dies as a result, direct result of David's sin. So Eaton, what's going on here? What happens with David? And Peter denying Christ, does he not get, you know, chastised for that? And Eaton, in trying to uphold the excellency of justification, said, well, the examples of David, the examples of Peter, other examples in the Old Testament, show that there was a time when believers would be punished for their sin and in a sense would actually lose their justification because of their sin. And so Eaton really created this, it's called this three eras of glory, each one revealing more and more God's glory. And the Old Testament fell under the area of darkness, where you actually could be chastised for your sin, and if you didn't keep the law perfectly, you actually could lose your justification. So that's the way Eaton kind of tried to explain how a believer could still be punished, could still be chastised. And he created this system of redemption that really essentially bifurcated the old from the new, the Old Testament from the New Testament. So that's why the Westminster Assembly realized this is a problem. Something needs to be done to address this. Mm-hmm. So
there are definitely really important issues there in trying to deal with all of these things. And the nature of those disagreements is of utmost importance. You know, can you lose your justification? Can you be truly justified and then one day not? But you almost have some different, I hate to say parties, but there are different groups out here. And so you have the Reform, but then you also have the Arminians who might be involved in the theological context of the day. And then you have antinomians, and it's yet to be determined, how they will be considered. We'll discuss that in minutes to come. But you write this, that the linchpin of disagreement between Arminians and antinomians and what caused Reformed theologians to react against both was whether justified sinners could receive divine chastisement for their sin. How did the different groups understand that? And did some of them just frankly not even have a category for that? If you truly are justified, then God can't consider your sin in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, so I think it's really helpful to point out the context, the theological context and political context, because they went together. But I make this case in the book that antinomianism really arose as a reaction against the prevailing Arminianism. So scholars are pretty much agreed that by this point in time, by the 1620s, 1630s, England's really ruled by Arminian theologians. Arminianism really has taken hold in England. So we see like King James sending a delegation of British theologians to the Synod of Dort. And he wants them to go, but then when they come back to England after the Synod, so the Synod of Dort ends in 1619, they urge the king to accept, to kind of take the canons of Dort and make them official in England. And King James doesn't want to do it because his country's split at that point. He has some theologians that are sympathetic to Arminius in high places of power. And so he dies without accepting or kind of taking the canons of Dort and making them law in England. So, and then his son, King Charles, is even more in the lines of Arminianism. King Charles marries a Catholic, and he actually likes the teachings of Arminius. So it gets even harder to do anything from the Reformed side once King Charles becomes king. So that's why you see, well, that's really the reason that the Westminster Assembly was called. You at the same time, you have a small minority of theologians pressing for reformation. And they bring petition after petition after petition to Parliament, asking for Parliament to call a religious assembly to revise the 39 Articles to make them more reformed. And so you have this kind of tension within England between Arminian theologians and ones that lean more towards reformed. And it's in that context that you have Eaton, who was called before, actually, William Laud, who was a very Arminian archbishop. Yeah.
Quality guy.
Yeah. So Eaton gets called before Laud and examined for his belief that God no longer punishes your sin once you're saved. Basically, Eaton's trying to say, hey, you Arminian theologian, you say that we can lose our salvation. No, we can't. And no matter what you do, you're safe, you're secure. And so he explicitly comes out against the Arminian theologians of the day. And there's a conference called the York House Conference, where these issues are debated, and the leaders of the Church of England basically say, hey, you know what? We're in charge. Mm-hmm. We don't care. They have this quote, we don't care what happened in some little village in the Netherlands. We don't like the Synod of Dort.
All our URC guys are upset now. Yeah. Hey.
This little Dutch village. Right. They call it a Dutch village. So they reject the canons of Dort. They reject the idea that once you're justified, you can still receive punishment. Because for them, you know, and Arminius taught this, if you're saved, if you're justified, God's grace is sufficient to keep you from performing these heinous sins. Is his grace not sufficient? Then if you fall into one of these heinous sins, you clearly aren't justified, or maybe you were, but you've clearly lost your justification, because God's grace would keep you from such horrible acts. So it is really a difference of an understanding of the remnant of sin in a believer. Can there be sin in a believer? And so that really is the context for Eaton to come out and make his claims.
Mm. What is fascinating about this discussion and bringing it maybe to the present day is that the way in which antinomianism tends to be defined, maybe in our own day, in our own circles, is, well, you're against the law, because that's what the word literally means, is against law. And so if you're against the law, or you're against the third use of the law, so-called third use of the law, as if the law has no application in the life of the believer, then you are antinomian. But if you're not against the law, if you don't hate God's law, then you must not be antinomian. And that's kind of what I'm hearing from you, is that the situation back in the 17th century is so much more sophisticated than that. And the idea of what antinomian antinomianism was back then and perhaps is today as well, is much more complex and sophisticated. And really the question isn't so much one of whether or not you hate God's law or you're against God's law, but it seems to be so much more complex and sophisticated than that.
Yeah, I think it was. And I think it's helpful to keep in mind that the players in this game were all highly educated, really smart theologians. Yeah. And Eaton himself, I mean, well, they all, not all, but they were trained at Oxford, they were trained at Cambridge, they were professors of theology. And they're godly men in that they were all pastors as well, you know, with years of preaching experience too. So, it's not just a, you know, anyone's debate. It's a pretty, sophisticated debate. And that's why in tracing the movement, it requires sophistication, I think, and even in discussing it, that, I think is important. Certainly when we consider a historical, you know, event like this, I think, again, what's going on today, some of the debates, it's a different context, but certainly when tracing what happened in the 1620s to 40s, these guys are, they're trained, they're well-trained theologians. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They know what they're talking about. So that I think in a sense makes it, it's a helpful thing to have in mind, because even these guys that have such advanced training, the issues were complex and difficult for them too. And so I think it's a helpful reminder for us to understand these are important issues. These are weighty issues that require diligence in working through and studying. So,
you know, you speak of the extent of antinomianism, you know, here starting, at least we have some records in 1629, I believe, and then on into the assembly in the 1640s. How widespread was it? And you know, there are some of these roll calls. Well, the assembly has a roll call, which I don't know the details, or at least I don't recall them, how they designated some of them antinomian. Did they have an asterisk or something on the roll call? But then John Eachard had an examination before the Court of High Commission in 1629, you write, and he provided a roll call of prominent London antinomian ministers. How many people were on these lists, and what indication do we have of their influence or, you know, widespread nature, at least at that time?
Yeah. So, it's a handful. It's a handful of guys at that point. There's also the issue of, press censorship. So at that time, William Laud, had imposed a censorship of the press. So we actually don't have a lot of written materials from anyone who would be, you know, put in the category of antinomian. So things don't really come out until the censorship is lifted. And so all we know basically is from, Eachard's, testimony, and then some other comments made by Eaton. By the 1640s, press, censorship is lifted, and there's more of an awareness of who these guys are because they start publishing basically. So, things are kind of kept under wraps until the early 1640s. And then 1642, there's an explosion of works published that as time goes on, as the theologians are reading these works, they get to be known as antinomian theologians. But in the early 1640s, there's really just a handful of guys, maybe six or seven. After the Westminster Assembly, so 1650s, the list, more continue to grow in London. So John Simpson, who gets called before the Westminster Assembly for being an antinomian, he becomes really famous, really popular in the 1650s. And he basically becomes a celebrity pastor in London. he was condemned by the assembly for being an antinomian. But he does become kind of one of the most famous pastors in London in the 1650s and 60s. So it becomes quite popular. And at the same time, Westminster Assembly and their works become condemned. So we see a shift that happens after the assembly.
You also suggest an interesting course of study here, maybe for somebody who'd like to go on and continue the story, continue the study. You know, what was their relationship perhaps to other groups? If they were condemned by the assembly, did they turn to other organizations? Did they develop their own movements? How are they related to other groups, perhaps even radical groups?
Yeah, that's a great question. So most of the men who were examined by the Westminster Assembly have connection to other groups as well. So they're Quakers. They're another group that's called the Levelers, the Ranters, a bunch of these groups.
Wow.
So antinomianism is just kind of one part of their theology. And there's a group called the Fifth Monarchy Men. So there's the belief that there's going to be this fifth, it's a theological belief that Christ is going to come and establish this fifth kingdom.
Wow.
And John Simpson is the one that started that movement.
Wow.
And he was called as an antinomian in the 1640s. So basically after the 1640s, things get crazier and crazier.
Do they have pamphlets? Like, I'm not asking in jest, but seriously, how do they proliferate their views? I mean, were they kind of like early bloggers of some sort?
In a sense, they were. In a sense, they were. Yeah. So we have a bunch of treatises, you know, short 5-10 page works. A lot of it was by preaching, actually. So they'd gain a reputation for preaching a certain way, and we have accounts of people flocking to hear these preachers, and so leaving. You know, you're supposed to go to your parish church, the church that's where you live, but we have accounts of people leaving, not going to the church they should be going, and going to hear these antinomian preachers.
Wow.
So a lot of it is word of mouth.
The more things change, the more they stay the same. And people driving past other good churches to go to the one they prefer.
Yeah.
We've been talking a lot about... Oh, go ahead, Jim.
No, I was just going to say, not very different from today, is it? I mean, you know, on the outside, maybe a little bit, but I mean, the heart is still the same, right?
Sure. You know, with all those people that live in South Austin driving up to Pflugerville, that's a problem.
But the whole thing, I don't blame them for that.
Right. You know, we've been talking a lot about John Eaton, but clearly there are other names and other antinomians that people would recognize. Could you speak to us a bit about Tobias Crisp? His name pops up quite often in certain theological discussions. What was his significance, and maybe what did he bring to the table in some of these debates?
Yeah, so Tobias Crisp is a little bit of a, he's a tricky one to categorize, I guess. So he was later than Eaton. He's kind of the next generation of antinomians. And he was more moderate. And when we see this, Eaton makes points, theological points, that then get kind of further embellished and expanded upon by the next generation in either more radical or less radical ways. So Crisp took Eaton's kind of main point about the nature of the Old Testament and justification in the Old Testament, and kind of made it a little bit more sophisticated. So a lot of what this goes back to is an understanding of the covenants.
Oh, sure.
And I know that's a big topic. That's a big issue.
Sure.
What is the nature of the covenant that stretches over the Old Testament? Is it purely one of works? Is it works plus grace mixed into it? Are there two covenants that are happening? And so Crisp, and the assembly found this as well in analyzing his works. He, I guess, would be categorized more as a moderate antinomian, in that he didn't believe that the entirety of the Old Testament was under covenant of works like Eaton did. He actually believed aspects of the Old Testament came under the covenant of grace. But he still would have held that the actual law, the Ten Commandments, would be solely under the covenant of works, and therefore not something that should be used or applied in the life of the believer today. So Crisp is a little bit more of a controversial figure, but according to the Westminster Assembly, he still fell under the the umbrella of an antinomian. So,
yeah.
Looking at the second half of the book, Whitney, in chapter four particularly, you begin to unpack for us the debates that took place with regard to the person and work of Christ, his active and passive obedience, how that plays into the discussions. Could you maybe begin to unpack some of that for us?
Sure. Yeah. So this kind of is one of the hearts of the debate, I guess, this issue. So the question comes down to if the believer does receive Christ's righteousness in justification, if Christ's righteousness is imputed to the believer, how does one keep from becoming an antinomian by saying, if I'm clothed in Christ's righteousness, I guess I can do whatever I want then, because right. God doesn't see my sin and he can't punish me because mm-hmm. Christ can't receive any more punishment than he already received. Mm-hmm. And so that came to be part of the issue of debate. So when the assembly turned to revising Article 11 of the 39 articles, so remember in context, they're working through each of the 39 articles, revising them, trying to make them more reformed. And as they turned to Article 11, that question came up from members of the assembly. If Christ has kept the law for us in our place on our behalf, then aren't we all antinomians? And so that kind of set the tone for the debate. And it's variously termed, as I say in the book, as the assembly's hot debate. It raged for a number of days, basically hours and hours, debating these issues. And if you ever get a chance, take out the minutes and flip through. It's fascinating to see these men kind of think through the issues. Extremely high level scholarly debate where they all know their Greek and Hebrew and they know their Bibles really well. And so it's a fascinating debate just to kind of analyze and flip through. But basically the question comes down to, how can we maintain that Christ's righteousness is imputed to us while yet holding on to the idea that there is still some necessity for us to follow the law? How do you work that out? And you know, at this point in time, the Westminster Confession hadn't been written yet.
Where are you going to turn?
Mm-hmm. It ends up being in chapter 11 of the confession, really, really well done. But these men are operating without it, obviously, because they hadn't written it yet. And so in a sense, this is kind of one of the first times that this debate had been played out in a way that, you know, we as historians can look back and see, you know, what each side is saying, who's saying what. So the assembly actually split into two different groups. One that held, surprisingly, that Christ's active obedience or his keeping of the law isn't actually a necessary part, is not a necessary aspect of justification. And they held to that precisely because they were afraid that if you do say that his righteousness is imputed to you, then you're going to be an antinomian. And then the other group, which said, no, we need his keeping of the law imputed to us. Otherwise, there is no justification.
Right.
And and you're still bound to keep the law because it's, and this is an interesting and very, I think, helpful point. They make the point that you're still bound to keep the law because it's part of your identity as a human created in God's image. And what part of what it means to be in God's image is obedience to his commands. And that doesn't change with the fall. That doesn't change ever. So that's still a necessary part of who you are. So that's a very kind of brief summary of the debate.
That's very good. Yeah. Chapter 11 of the Westminster Confession of Faith is fascinating. It's so important. And I've always been intrigued by the historical discussions behind some of these articles. One that sticks out to me so much is section 4. And I'm curious about Crisp and some others. I wonder if you could give me some of the background, but if I can read 11:4, at least in I'm reading off the OPC's version, so if it's been adjusted, you can correct me, but I'm sure it has somehow. But it says, God did from all eternity decree to justify all the elect, and Christ did in the fullness of time die for their sins and rise again for their justification. Nevertheless, they are not justified until the Holy Spirit doth, in due time, actually apply Christ unto them. There's a couple things there that are interesting that are on that come on the heels of what you just mentioned in terms of the debates. One is the role of the Holy Spirit. I'm curious about, you know, all the aspects there, and I'm thinking personally, just out loud, not asking you to respond, but thinking out loud of, you know, texts like Romans 8, 3, and 4, which talk about how the righteous requirement of the law is fulfilled in us. That seems, in one way, to have to do with our union with Christ in his death, because we just got that in Romans 6. But then also, Paul says, who, you know, the righteous requirement of the law is fulfilled in us who do not walk according to the flesh, but walk in the Spirit. So it seems also that the Spirit raises us up to a newness of life, that we would live in a way that pleases God according to his law. But specifically speaking here, this eternal aspect of justification, you know, what was going on in the milieu that people were saying, well, you know, or if we're justified, maybe we have to be justified from all eternity. If God knew that this was going to happen, was there ever a real transition from wrath to grace, for example? And in many ways, this foreshadows some of the debates that are going to happen in the 1920s in the CRC.
Yes. So that phrase, you know, any phrasing in chapter 11 that has to do with this justification occurring in time, mm-hmm. Were actually added. They were put in specifically because of the antinomian controversy. So yeah. One of the positions of many of the antinomians was that we're actually justified from all eternity, in a sense, to kind of stave off the idea that you could lose it, lose your justification. They said, well,
you never weren't.
Exactly.
Right.
There's nothing to lose because you've always had it. So they make statements, for instance, such as, you merely need to apprehend your justification. So it's something that you have actually. And it's an issue of apprehension. Rather interesting. And again, that caused a lot of debate on the floor of the assembly too, because good point, right? Like, God's plan is eternal. His decrees are eternal. How do we accurately reflect the biblical texts that hold God's eternal decree and also justification occurring at a certain point in time? How do we put those two things together? And I think the result, chapter 11 of the confession, is pretty much unmatched as far as what I've come across is something that actually lays that out. But yeah, that was definitely something brought up specifically by a number of antinomian theologians.
Just a follow-up question, going back to what you said previous about the response of the one side of the assembly as to how you can be declared righteous on the basis of Christ's act of obedience and the due that a creature owes to God is obedience. What were some of the other reasons or rationale as to why the believer still had to obey God? Were there other reasons? And I think, you know, I'm going back to maybe the Heidelberg Catechism a century before, which is, of course, talking about sin, grace, and gratitude. Gratitude as also a motivating factor for obedience. Was that also present in the debates? And in addition to that, were there other reasons, or maybe we could say motivations for obedience for the believer who was perfectly justified by the perfect and full obedience of Christ?
Yeah. So. Great question. And this is a point that's rather interesting in that there's not much reference to any earlier catechisms or kind of confessions, which was a little surprising to me. There's brief references to some councils, church councils, mm-hmm. That occurred in the past. But as far as like directly referencing like the Heidelberg, that doesn't occur, which is a little surprising to me. And you know, we could talk about why or why not. But yeah, so going back to the one side of the assembly's kind of determination that no, we still need to keep the law of reason. So first would be because it's part of who we are as humans, created in God's image. Second, and this relates to the first, but the second would be, that's how God has always operated from the beginning of time. So not only with Adam, where God creates him, then tells him what to do and what not to do. Even after the fall, that still continued. So we see even, and they talk about God's covenant with Abraham, where God appears to Abraham. What does he say? I am the Lord your God. Walk before me and be blameless, be righteous, be perfectly righteous. That's the start of the covenant of grace. The covenant of grace starts off with God saying, hey, you got to be perfect. and, you know, Abraham can't be perfect. So we see, you know, God taking on Abraham's side of the covenant, but that standard still remains. And they continue on, you know, tracing the history of redemption. And, you know, with the Mosaic covenant, how does it start? I'm the Lord your God. I have rescued you. Now here's how you live. And so they make the argument that this isn't weird. This is normal. There's actually no tension. This is how God has always operated. So they kind of fall back on the continuing unification of God's plan of redemption rather than the bifurcation that antinomians, were kind of trying to use to answer some of these questions. And certainly they talk about, being obedient out of gratitude. But that actually isn't as much of a stress. They don't really stress as much the issue of gratitude and obeying the law out of thankfulness so much as it's part of who we are as God's people. This is what we do.
Sure. If I could follow up with that, and I can geek out all day with the confession because it's just so awesome on this issue. But in chapter 19, I love this language that's used in Article 7. Neither are the forementioned uses of the law, which of course is talking about the use of the law in the life of the believer, neither are the forementioned uses of the law contrary to the grace of the gospel, but do sweetly comply with it. Mm-hmm. That language of sweetly comply is just such, I mean, I kind of sense that they have antinomianism in their targets, that the tension that we may sense between having the perfect, the full obedience of Christ imputed to us, and then the obligation of the believer to obey, that tension is in our mind only. Mm-hmm. And that, and in the mind of God and in the scriptures, that is not a contradiction, but in fact, do sweetly comply with one another.
Yeah, I love that. And that phrase, I pick up in the book as well and highlight it because it is it's a sweet phrase. And I think that was in the mind of the assembly, and that section was actually, again, added in because of their desire to clearly explain everything because of antinomianism. And yeah, when you think through the Psalms and how much the psalmist loves God's law, it's and they reference that as well. There's not really a tension biblically. They go together. I love that phrase. It's a beautiful phrase. Hmm.
You know, I mentioned earlier Sinclair Ferguson's book, The Whole Christ, which talks quite a bit about the Merrill controversy. And there have been several works lately about that controversy. That controversy was kind of occasioned in the early 18th century for people that might want to know. But the book that it was largely about regarding was The Merrill of Modern Divinity, which, as far as my records go, was originally published in the 1640s, 1645 perhaps, by an E.F., you know, a lot of people think that's Edward Fisher, who was a lay theologian, as it were. But it's interesting to see. I'm curious how if you could connect that for us. Do you see any specific connection between the context in the 1640s? And I'm interested to see how the Merrill of Modern Divinity rose up again in the early 17th century. was there a kind of a parallel attention or rise of the Westminster Standards here following all that tumult to come after the assembly actually wrote its documents? Was that, you know, a companion or perhaps even kind of an interpretive grid for the Marrow later to come?
Yeah, so that's a fascinating kind of story to trace. So the Marrow was most likely actually already written before the 1640s.
Oh, wow.
It couldn't be published because of the press censorship. Yeah. So it comes out in the 40s.
Okay.
But most likely an earlier work. And it arose really in the same kind of context in the 1620s and 30s in London. I mean, it's a London book. It's an English issue. And then what happens is after the restoration of the monarchy in 1660, the Westminster Assembly and its confession and its catechism, all of its documents basically get thrown out. They're actually publicly burned. England doesn't like them anymore. Okay.
Yeah.
So, but what happens is that they're taken to Edinburgh, taken to Scotland, and they become, the standards become the documents of the Church of Scotland. We see Scotland being established along the lines of the Westminster Standards. And then when this controversy happens in Scotland, it really comes down to issues of, where do you stand as far as the Westminster Standards on this issue of law and gospel? So it's the Marrow controversy really couldn't have happened if the assembly hadn't kind of already worked through some of these issues and laid out them in their confession. So we see the work of the assembly being used in that controversy, which is interesting because, you know, it's an English assembly. The Marrow is an English work, but it's really in Scotland that this later controversy occurs. So
that's something that comes through quite a bit. Whenever you study the assembly, you always get these different parties involved, and it's not only a division by ecclesiastical bodies. You know, you might end up with some Congregationalists, you end up with some Presbyterian of different varieties. I think one of the other books by Dr. Spearer addressed that, the role of the Scottish commissioners at the Westminster Assembly, if I'm not mistaken. I have to check my notes on that. It's been a couple of years. It's not only to say people might have different ecclesiastical affiliations, but certainly that these national lines are very significant. And how did antinomianism kind of overlay with these boundaries? You mentioned England, that the Marrow was written in an English context, but it was censored and perhaps not possible even to be published until the 1640s. But then you also have Wales. Carl Truman's not a big fan of Wales, but Wales is can hold its own. You have Ireland, you know, and Scotland. And so did antinomianism and the relationship among antinomians and reform differ in different countries? Did those country dynamics, national dynamics, have anything to say about how those groups related?
Yeah, so there were a group of Scottish commissioners sent down to the assembly.
Yeah, those are our heroes. At least,
yeah.
like at least mine. Yeah.
And I think where their greatest impact really was in taking the standards back up to Scotland. So
yeah.
That really, you know, once the monarchy was restored, honestly, Presbyterianism and Reformed theology in England basically dies. I mean, so it's really in Scotland that the kind of heritage of the Reformation occurs, and hence its own antinomian controversy, you know, decades later. Not so much in Wales. Wales is kind of its own category of things that are going on.
More ways than one.
And as far as I'm aware, there wasn't a corresponding antinomian controversy in Ireland. What does happen is through missionaries to North America, we see stuff happening in New England even earlier, like in the 1630s. But again, it has a different flavor. There's different things at play during that time. But yeah.
You know, toward the end of the book, we don't need to conclude here, but at least in the book's conclusion, you draw out some of these connections you just mentioned on how, you know, things didn't, you anticipated how things didn't necessarily work out so well, governmentally speaking, in England after the assembly was done. Just in this final paragraph here in the book, you say, as others have shown, the assembly's work was in a large sense a failure. I mean, some people might hear that, not understand the original context. In what ways was it a failure? You know, ultimately, the theology is a very good thing. We're very thankful for the for the standards and their proliferation throughout the world in many different denominations now. But how perhaps did the assembly not ultimately deliver on what it at least originally intended to do?
Yeah, so it is a little bit of a downer to end on that, but it was a failure in the sense that the assembly was called to bring Reformation to England. That was its purpose. That was its goal. And when it was called in the 1640s, early 1640s, that was what it set out to do, was to reform the documents of the Church of England. And that failed because of the restoration of the monarchy. England theologically basically resets itself, pushes the rewind button and play, and goes back to where it was before the Westminster Assembly was called theologically. That's kind of what I meant by that point.
Sure.
Certainly theologically. In other ways, it was a great success.
Oh no, yeah, I understood where you're coming from with the conclusion, and I think it's just helpful to think about that because, you know, standing now, 350 years later, almost 400 years later, you lose sight of the scale. And if you would have lived at this time, if you would have been a Reformed person, perhaps even Presbyterian in England, you know, you would have been riding high for a while, and then just to see what happened, you know, it would be almost devastating. Then to see the history of how things moved into Scotland, eventually how Scottish Presbyterianism came to influence the United States, and then some of the freedoms that were afforded, you know, Presbyterians in the United States allowed it to perhaps flourish in my opinion, better ways than in the ways that they were able to develop over in Scotland and in England. So we see, you know, in hindsight, God's providence and the way in which he was working. But in this moment, you know, perhaps our historical distance, we lose sight of what the assembly originally intended to do and how it didn't really turn out so well, at least in those decades.
Yeah. And Dr. Van Dixhorn mentions that, references that in his works too, the kind of almost depression that fell upon members of the assembly as they see their work kind of, in a sense, unravel in the years following the assembly. So,
oh, that's really helpful. I got one oddball question for you. This might be kind of like free association and not something derived. Wow. I think I've been reading too much of this old English. I'm starting to invent words. You know, way back in the 1500s, you had John Knox. So I'm already thinking of John Knox because of his Scottish heritage and very appreciative of his work. But we're also have been talking to some degree about the 39 Articles and a Reformed interpretation of them. And something I learned of from Carl Truman when I took church history was the Black Rubric. And I found that not too many people understand or know at least the Black Rubric and what that refers to. I'm curious to know, I mean, was that ever referenced? You know, as far as I know, it was a piece of paper, an actual rubric that was pasted into the books that they would use, you know, to describe how the Lord's Supper ought to have been. You can correct me on all this because I'm not a historian, but it was a way to interpret the 39 Articles so that you would come away from them with a more reformed understanding of the Lord's Supper. And so that is kind of an early anticipator, perhaps, about how you might approach the 39 Articles as a Reformed person. It's kind of like, this is the way you ought to read this. This is what Cranmer meant, and this is how we ought to read them. I would be very interested to know if that ever popped up in the minutes, or if that was something ever debated and used as an example that, hey, when we're doing the Westminster Standards, we need to be thinking in the way perhaps that Knox did.
Yeah, that's a great question. As far as I'm aware, I don't recall it coming up.
Sure.
And, you know, I am not infallible on that point. It definitely could have. As far as I remember, I don't remember a discussion on it. I mean, there certainly were different shades of, I guess, understanding and ways of coping with the 39 Articles amongst different assembly members. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, the goal of the assembly as a whole was really to throw them out.
Yeah.
And really not, in a sense, start from scratch, use them as a foundation, but completely reform them. So that really was kind of their understanding, their goal with the documents, all the documents of the Church of England. So
did any of the later groups, I'm thinking perhaps of like the Savoy Declaration, for example, how did they end up treating the Westminster Standards? Did they largely stand upon the same foundation? Are there any indications that there were some alterations to some of the Westminster Assembly's statements about antinomianism, either toning them down or strengthening them? How did some of that happen?
Yeah, so we see actually later theologians and Owen being one of the key guys to kind of keep the continuity, using the Confession of Faith as a basis. I mean, even the London Baptist Confession, it's basically the Westminster Confession with a few alterations.
Yeah.
So it was definitely used in England as a foundation for a number of later confessions as well. So.
What gets you most excited about this study now? You've written this book. It's tremendous. I encourage everyone to get a copy and to read it. But you've sketched out some areas for further study. But if you yourself or wanted to see students of yours or colleagues of yours wanted to continue the study here, without giving away any secrets, if you don't want people jumping in your territory, what gets you most excited? What are the questions that you really want to know the answer to that you can't say right now with certainty or with a high degree of certainty that you know them already?
Oh man, there's so much historically. Yeah. That's waiting to be kind of analyzed and uncovered. Really on kind of almost any point that I covered in my book, there could be more books written, book lengths. So historically there was so much going on theologically. I mean, these issues to me are just so important and so essential. I'm very excited and passionate about my students understanding the work of Christ in a way that that is biblical. So many come from an evangelical background, even a Reformed background, don't understand the work of Christ fully. You know, they know Jesus died for my sins. Mm-hmm. Well, yes, he did. He also lived a perfect life for you.
Yeah.
So to me, that's an issue that is still so relevant and something that I'm excited about teaching and working further on. But yeah, there's a lot that still needs to be done in this area. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, it doesn't get much more practical than that, much more day-to-day, moment-by-moment, to understand how Christ lived for us, died for us, how he was raised for our justification, how he's ascended on high, and then our relationship to him and what that means for us at every single point. So, I mean, these aren't new questions, but and we have great answers here from history, but also these are continually things we need to keep thinking about. So lest people think that this is some sort of stale, dry debate that doesn't have any bearing upon our lives today, that they would be sorely mistaken. They need to get this book and to recognize that these are matters that face our churches today. And like we said at the beginning, the last 6 or 7 years on Twitter demonstrate I think the importance of learning these lessons, right? Because yeah. these things really matter. You know, how now shall we live, kind of to paraphrase yeah. Francis Schaeffer and others. But it's everything. Yeah. And so I encourage people to check this out. But I see, Whitney, you're also, maybe it's already out, but your faculty webpage says you're also contributing a chapter in the forthcoming series, The History of Scottish Theology, published mm-hmm. by OUP. Could you tell us a little bit about that, just in case the listeners want to put that on the shelf?
Yeah, so it's a three-volume history of Scottish theology. It's the first of its kind, and the collaborative work, there's over 70 authors who are involved. Oh, wow. And so my chapter is basically on the role of the Scottish commissioners at Westminster and then their impact back in Scotland. So it's an exciting volume. It's, I think, not slated to come out until next year or maybe the year after. Okay. But it's definitely going to be something that you'll want to look out for. So
yes, and we can include a link to that in the description as well, because most people will be listening to this right when it comes out, but you can either flag it for future purchase, or if you're listening later on in the archives, then it's definitely something that you're going to want to pick up. This has been tremendous. Thanks for taking the time today to talk to us. This was really fun. I appreciate your willingness to come on the program and enlighten us a bit. Thanks, Whitney.
Well, thanks for having me. This has been great.
Anytime. We'd love to have you back. We'd like people to visit Whitney online. You can find at least the faculty page at providencecc.edu. You can find Whitney Gamble, and then there are links also to her host page at the White Horse Inn. She's been a frequent contributor to the White Horse Inn and discussing about a range of issues. So that's all at whitehorseinn.org/host/Whitney-Gamble, as well as the link to the publications. And again, Providence Christian College is out in Pasadena, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, while you're there checking Whitney's information out, you can find out information about the school, how to contact them, and they have applications, newsletters, all sorts of things available there. So I'm sure they'd love to talk to you as well. So if you have young ones or, you know, parishioners in your church looking for a place to study, great place to go. Nice place to live, too. You can't go wrong in Pasadena. Head on over to the Rose Bowl. Yeah, and you can find us online at reformedforum.org. Again, there's information about all of our programs and events going on the website. And I do so much. Thank you for listening. I hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.